Hello and welcome to this episode of Folklore, Food and Fairy Tale. As always, first we'll have the story, then some talk about the folklore and the story itself, and then we'll move on to the food and today's recipe. Our story is The Slippers of the 12 Princesses from Romanian Tales and Legend, as translated by E.B. Moore and dedicated to the Queen of Romania. The book, that is, not this podcast. Are you ready, gentle listener? Then I'll begin. Once upon a time, when times were very different to what they are now, there lived a cowherd who had neither father nor mother. He was called Jonica, that is to say, Johnny, but people had given him the name of Gura Kaska, open mouth, because when he led his cows to pasture, he bellowed everything he met on his way. Otherwise, he was a very pretty young man. His hair was fair, and his eyes as blue as a morsel of the sky. The young girls of the village teased him sadly. "Hey, hey, Jonica, where are you off going with your open mouth?" "What does that matter to you?" he'd reply tranquilly and pass on his way. Though he was only a cowherd, he was sufficiently proud of his good looks, and he knew that he didn't find the village girls very attractive. He had heard tell that down there, a long way off, in the towns, the young girls were quite different, that they had throats as white as alabaster, pink cheeks, delicate and soft hands, their small feet covered by satin slippers, that in short they were clad in robes of silk and gold and were called princesses. So, that while his comrades only sought to please some village maiden, he dreamed neither more nor less that he should marry a princess. One noonday in the middle of the August, when the sun was so scorching that even the flies did not know where to put themselves, Jonica sat down under the shadow of an oak to eat his mamaliga and a morsel of sheep's milk cheese. Seeing that his flock was lying peaceably about, he stretched himself at full length and was soon asleep. He had a charming dream. Azina, a fairy, appeared to him, beautiful as the day, fresh as a rose, and clad in a robe sparkling with diamonds. She said to him, "There is a country where precious stones grow. Go to the court of the emperor who reigns there, and you will marry a princess." In the evening, when he took his cows back to their shed, Jonica recounted his dream to several of his friends, who freely laughed at him. But the words of Azina had had such an influence on him that he laughed himself at the ridicule of which he was the object. The next day, at the same hour and the same place, our cowherd came to take his siesta. He had the same dream, and the same fairy, more radiant than ever, appeared again to him and repeated, "There is a country where precious stones grow. Go to the court of the emperor who reigns there, and you will marry a princess." Jonica again repeated his dream, and it was again turned into ridicule. "What does it matter to me?" said Jonica, "if they laugh. I know one thing, and if that fairy appears again to me, I'll follow her advice." On the following day, he had the same dream. He got up joyfully, and in the evening they heard him in the village singing, "I quit the cows and calves, and I'm going to marry the daughter of an emperor." His master, who overheard him, became thoughtful. But Jonica said to him, "You may do and think as you like, but it's decided. I'm going away." He began to make his preparations, and in the morning he left. The people of the village held their sides laughing when they saw him with his little bundle on a stick slung across his shoulder, descend the hill, traverse the plain, and then slowly disappear in the dim distance. In those days, people did say there really was a country where precious stones grew, as grass, plants and flowers grow in other places. It was said that the emperor of these parts had 12 daughters, 12 princesses, the one lovelier than the other, but all as proud as they were beautiful. It was said also that they only went to sleep at sunrise and got up at midday. They lived all together in one large room of the palace and slept in beds of gold encrusted with flowers of diamonds and emeralds. When the princesses retired in the evening, the 9 doors of their apartment were locked outside with 9 padlocks. It was impossible for them to get out, and yet each night something very extraordinary took place. The satin slippers of the 12 princesses were literally worn out each morning. One might have thought the daughters of the emperor had danced all night. When they were questioned, they declared that they knew nothing and could understand nothing about it. No one could explain the strange fact, for notwithstanding the greatest watchfulness, not the least noise had ever been heard in the chamber of the princesses after they had retired to rest. The emperor, their father, was most perplexed and determined at any price to penetrate this mystery. He had a trumpet sounded, and it was published throughout all the country that if anyone succeeded in finding out by what means his daughters, the princesses, wore out their slippers in a single night, he might choose from amongst them his wife. At this news, a great number of emperor's sons and king's sons presented themselves to explore this adventure. They hid themselves behind a great curtain in the chamber of the princesses. But once there, no one ever heard from them, ever again. They never reappeared. Arjonika, who arrived just then at the court of the emperor, heard talk of all these matters and succeeded in being taken into the service of one of the imperial gardeners, who'd been obliged to send away one of his best helpers. His new master did not find him very intelligent, but he was convinced that his curling light hair and good looks would make him acceptable to the princesses. Thus, his daily duty then was each morning to present a bouquet to the daughters of the emperor. Jonica posted himself at their door at the hour of their awakening, and as each came forth, he presented her with a bouquet. They found the flowers very beautiful, but disdained to cast a look or smile on poor Jonica, who remained there more than ever, Gura Kaska, open mouth. Lena, alone, the youngest, most graceful and prettiest of the princesses, let fall by hands on him a look as soft as velvet. "Ah, oh, my sister," said she, "how good-looking our young gardener is." They burst into mocking laughter, and the eldest remarked to Lena that it was unbecoming of a princess to lower her eyes to a servant. Nevertheless, Jonica, intoxicated by the looks and beauty of Lena, saw to the promise of the emperor, and it entered his head to try and discover the mystery of the slippers. He did not mention it to anyone, though, for he was afraid that the emperor might hear of it, be angry, and have him driven away from court as a punishment for his audacity. While these thoughts were passing through his brain, Jonica dreamed again of the fairy with the sparkling robe. She held in her right hand two small laurel branches, one as red as a cherry and the other like a rose. In her left hand was a little golden spade, a watering can of the same metal, and a silken veil. She gave all these to Jonica, saying, "Plant these two laurels in large boxes, turn over the earth with this spade, water them with this watering can, and wipe them with this silken veil. When they have grown 3 feet high, say to each separately, 'Beautiful laurels, with a golden spade I have dug you, with a golden watering can I have watered you, and with a silken veil I have wiped you.' This said, you can ask anything you wish, and it will accord you." When Jonica awoke, he found the two laurels and the other objects on the table, and fell on his knees to thank the good fairy. He at once began to carry out her instructions. The shrubs grew rapidly, and when they had attained the necessary height, he went to the cherry laurel and said, "Beautiful cherry laurel, with a golden spade I have dug you, with a golden watering can I have watered you, and with a silken veil I have wiped you. Grant me in exchange the gift of becoming invisible whenever I desire." Immediately he saw grow out from the laurel a beautiful white flower. He gathered it, placed it in his buttonhole, and at once became invisible. When night arrived, the princesses went up to their bedroom, and Jonica, barefooted so as to make no noise, glided up behind them and hid himself under one of the 12 beds. Then, instead of preparing themselves to go to bed, each of the princesses opened a wardrobe and took out their richest dresses and finest jewels, each assisting the other. They dressed in a grand toilette. Jonica could see nothing from his hiding place, but he heard them laugh and dance with joy. The eldest, who seemed to have great authority over them, hurried them and kept explaining, "Be quick, my sisters, our dancers are dying of impatience." At the end of the hour, the laughing and talking ceased. Jonica carefully put out his head and saw the princesses were dressed like fairies. They wore quite new satin slippers and held in their hands the bouquets which he had offered them in the morning. They placed themselves one behind the other, and the eldest, who was all at the head, struck 3 blows in a peculiar manner on a certain part of the wall. A door, quite invisible, opened, and the princesses disappeared. Jonica followed them noiselessly, but by accident he placed his foot on the train of the Princess Lena. "There's someone behind me," she cried. "Someone trod on my dress." The eldest turned round quickly, but seeing no one, exclaimed, "How foolish you are, Lena. You must have caught it against a nail." The 12 daughters of the emperor descended and descended and descended until they arrived at an underground passage, at the end of which was an iron door with a strong bolt. The eldest opened this, and then they found themselves in an enchanted bower, where the leaves of the trees were in silver and sparkled in the moonlight. They walked on until they came to a second bower, and here the trees had golden leaves still on. And then they came to a third bower, where the leaves were of emeralds and rubies and diamonds, and their rays so bright that one might have thought it was full daylight. The princesses continued their walk, and Jonica, still following, arrived on them soon on the borders of a large lake. On this lake were 12 boats, and in each boat was one of the lost sons of an emperor, who, oar in hand, each waited for a princess. Jonica took his place in the boat of Princess Lena. The boat, being more heavily laden, could not float so quickly as the others, and so was always behind. "I do not know," said Lena to her cavalier, "why we do not go so quickly as at other times. What can be the matter?" I don't understand it either, said the emperor's son. I row with all of my might. On the other side of the lake, the little gardener perceived a beautiful palace, illuminated as giorno, and held harmonious sounds of violins, trumpets, and cymbals. The emperor's sons, each having a princess on his arm, entered the palace, and after them came Jonica into a saloon lighted by 10 lights. The walls were immense mirrors and golden frames set with precious stones. On a centre table, a massive golden vase contained an enormous bouquet of flowers, which gave forth an exquisite perfume. Poor Jonica was literally dazed and petrified by the sight of so much splendour. When able to look at and admire the princesses in the midst of this dazzling light, he lost his wits completely and looked so ardently with his eyes that one would have thought he wished to taste them also with his mouth. Some were fair, some were brown, and nearly all of them had let fall their beautiful hair down to their pretty shoulders. Never even in his dreams had the poor boy seen such enchantresses. But amongst them all, and above all, it was Lena, who seemed to him to have the most graceful, the most beautiful, the most intoxicating, with her dark eyes and long hair, the shade of a raven's wing. And with what fire she danced! Leaning on the shoulder of her cavalier, Lena turned as light as a spindle. Her face was flushed, her eyes shone like 2 stars, and it was evident that dancing was her greatest delight. Poor Jonica let fall envious looks on the emperor's sons, and heartily regretted that he wasn't amongst them, so that he might have had the right to be cavalier to such a beautiful young woman. All these dancers, to the number of 50, were emperor's sons who had tried to discover the secret of the princesses. These latter had enticed them to a midnight expedition and had given them to drink at table an enchanted beverage, which had frozen their blood, killed in them every sentiment of love, every remembrance or worldly desire, leaving them only the ardent pleasure of the dance in the bosom of the splendid palace, and became henceforth their eternal habitation. The princesses danced until their white satin slippers were in holes, until the cock had crowed 3 times. Then the music ceased. Servants arranged a princely table, which was instantaneously filled with the most succulent meats and the rarest and most exquisite wines, as well as sugared orange flowers, crystallised rose leaves, powdered violets, cracknels, wafers and other dishes, which are, as everyone knows, the favourite food of princesses. Each one took his place and ate and drank with ease, excepting our poor Gura Kaska, who had to content himself with feasting his eyes alone. When the repast was over, the princesses re-entered their boats, and Jonica, who followed them step by step, arrived with them in the wood with the silver leaves. There, to prove himself, and also to prove to others that what he had seen was no dream, Jonica broke off a branch of the tree with the beautiful leaves. The noise which he made called Lena to turn round. "What can that be?" she said to her sisters. "It was nothing," replied her eldest sister. "It was only the screech of the barn owl that roosts in one of the turrets of the castle." While she was speaking, Jonica managed to slip in front and, running up the staircase, reached the princess's room first. He flung open the window and slid down the vine, which climbed up the wall, found himself in the garden just as the sun was beginning to rise, and it was time for him to set to his work. While preparing the flowers for the princesses, he hid part of the branch of silver leaves in the bouquet destined for Lena. Great was the astonishment of the princess, who asked herself in vain how it was possible that the branch could have come there. Without saying anything to her sisters, she went down into the garden, and there, under the shade of a large chestnut tree, she found the gardener. She had for a moment a great mind to speak to him, but on reflection thought it was better to wait a little, and so passed on her way. When the evening arrived, the princesses again returned to the castle for the ball. Jonica followed them, and a second time entered Lena's boat. Again the emperor's son complained of labour required in rowing. "No doubt it's the heat which you feel," replied Lena. "All passed as on the previous evening, but this time, on returning, Jonica broke off a branch of the golden leaves." This time it was the eldest sister who questioned the noise. "What can that be?" said she to her sisters. "It was nothing," replied Lena. "It was only the screech of the barn owl that roosts in one of the turrets of the castle." Again, while she was speaking, Jonica managed to slip in front, running up to the staircase, reached the princess's room first. He flung open the window again and slid down the vine, and found himself back in the garden just as it was time for him to start work. When the daily bouquets were distributed, the Princess Lena found, concealed in hers, the golden branch. Remaining a little behind her sisters and showing the golden branch to Jonica, she asked, "From whence did you have those leaves?" "Your Highness knows quite well." "So, you followed us?" "Yes, Highness." And how did you manage that? It's a secret. We didn't see thee. I was invisible. At any rate, I see that thou hast penetrated the mystery. Speak of it to no one, and take this purse as a price of thy silence. And she threw to the poor boy a purse of gold. I do not sell my silence, says Jeannequin, with a haughtiness which astonished the princess. I know how to hold my tongue without being paid for it. And he walked away, leaving the purse on the ground. The three succeeding days, Lina saw nor heard anything particular during their nocturnal excursions. But the fourth night, there was a distinct rustling in the wood of diamond leaves, and the next morning she found a diamond branch hidden in her bouquet. Then she was fully convinced the young gardener knew all their escapades, and calling him to her, she asked, "Dost thou know the price which the Emperor our father offers for the discovery of our secret?" "I know it, Highness." "Then why don't you go to him and betray it?"
"I do not wish to betray you."
"Are you afraid?"
"No, Highness."
"Then why won't you speak?" Jeannequin looked up at her, his eyes full of expression, but did not reply. While Lina was talking with the youth, her sisters were laughing at her, and when she came back they still went on with their ridicule, till she became quite red with anger. "You can marry him," said her sisters. "There's nothing to prevent it. You can be the gardener's wife, and you can live in a cottage at the bottom of the garden. You can help your husband draw the water from the fountain, and you can offer us our daily bouquets." Lina became still more angry, and the weight of her anger fell on poor Jeannequin. When he again presented her with flowers, she took them with supreme indifference, and treated him with the greatest disdain. The poor fellow could not understand it, for he was always most respectful. He never dared to look her full in the face, and yet she felt he was present with her all day long. At length she came to the resolution to confide to her sisters all that she knew. "What?" cried they. "This stupid boy has learned our secret, and you've kept it from us? We must at once absolutely get rid of him." "By what means?" "Have him stabbed and thrown in a cave." This was the usual way by which troublesome people were disposed of in that country. But Lina would not hear of this, saying the poor boy had committed no fault. "If you touch a hair of his head," she said, "I will go and confess all to our father, the emperor." To quieten Lina, it was decided to get Jeannequin to go again to the ball and to make him drink the enchanted beverage which would put him in the same state as the other cavaliers. So they called the young gardener to them, and the eldest sister asked him by what means he had discovered their secret, but he would give them no answer. Then they informed him of the decision which they had come to respecting him. He replied that he accepted it, and that he would drink willingly the enchanted beverage so as to become the cavalier of her whom he loved. On the day this was to happen, wishing to have as fine a clothes and be able to make as handsome presents as the emperor's sons, Jeannequin went to the rose laurel and said, "My beautiful rose laurel, I have dug you with a golden spade, I have watered you with a golden watering can, I have wiped you with a silken veil. Grant that in one moment I may be as richly dressed as an emperor's son." Immediately he saw a beautiful flower expand, and gathering it, he was at once clad in velvet as dark and soft as Lina's eyes, a toque to match, with an agraffe of diamonds and a flower in his buttonhole. From being rugged and outdoors, his complexion became as fresh as an infant's, and his beauty was marvellous. Even his manner changed completely, and anyone might have thought him really an emperor's son. Thus metamorphosed, he presented himself before the emperor to ask his authority to try in his turn to unravel the secret of the princesses. He was so changed that the emperor did not recognise him. When the princesses went back to their bedroom, Jeannequin was waiting for them behind the door. After their usual excursion, Jeannequin gave his arm to the eldest princess and afterwards danced with each of the sisters successfully and with so much dignity and grace that they were all enchanted. When it was Lina's turn, he was in raptures, but he did not address a single word to her. While conducting her to her place, the princess said to him jokingly, "Being treated like an emperor's son, you must be in blissful happiness." "Never fear, princess," replied he, "you shall not be a gardener's wife." Lina looked at him half frightened, but he walked away without waiting for her answer. When the princesses had once more danced until their slippers were in holes, the music ceased and the servants prepared the table as usual, and Jeannequin was placed at the right hand of the eldest princess and facing Lina. He was served with the most delicate meats, the choicest wines, the most beautiful candied flowers. Compliments and praises were showered on him, but he was neither intoxicated by their wines nor by their flatteries. Presently the eldest princess made a sign, and one of the servants came forward bearing a massive golden cup.
This enchanted palace has no longer any secrets for thee, cried the princess to Jonica. Let us drink to your triumph. The young man, casting a tender glance at Lena, raised the cup to his lips.
Don't drink it, she cried impetuously. Don't drink it. I'd rather be a gardener's wife.
And she began to weep. Jonica threw the enchanted beverage over his shoulder, cleared the table, and fell on his knees at the feet of Princess Lena. All the other emperor's sons fell each at the feet of their respective princesses, who, choosing them for their husbands, held out their hands and raised them from the ground. The charm was finally broken. The 12 couples crossed the lake in boats, traversed the forest, passed through the cellar, and arrived at the emperor's chamber. Jonica, with a golden cup in his hand, explained to him the mystery of the worn-out slippers. God give thee life, young man, said the emperor. Take your choice from amongst my daughters. My choice has been made for a long time, he said, taking by the hand the Princess Lena, who blushed and could not look up. The Princess Lena did not become a gardener's wife, for Jonica became a prince. Before their marriage took place, Lena inquired of him how he had discovered their secret. Jonica showed her the two laurels. Lena, like an intelligent woman, thought that Jonica would have too great an advantage over her if he enjoyed the power which was given to him by possessing these shrubs, so she tore the laurels up by their roots and flung them in the fire. A short time afterwards, the marriage took place with imperial splendour. It was followed by festivities which lasted 3 days and 3 nights, and the young people lived very happily together to a good old age. And that, gentle listener, is the end of my tale, and I hope it pleased you, for it had no other purpose. So, what did you think? I always feel for the trapped princes, but when I was young and heard this for the first time, I really just wanted to visit the forest of silver, gold and diamonds. I was fascinated as well by the banquet that the princesses ate. I did, however, think, even then, that after all that dancing, they might have fancied something a touch more filling. I imagine many of you are familiar with this fairy tale, but do you know where it came from? Tale type for this one is ATU 306, and although there are over 100 variations in Central Europe, it's not really known beyond Russia, or even popular in France. It's not really even that old, probably dating from the 17th century, according to Stith Thompson. D.L. Ashleman has created an excellent resource which collects tale types together, with examples of that tale type, and listing several versions. The shoes that were danced to pieces from Germany as told by Grimm, the princess with the 12 pairs of golden shoes from Denmark, the invisible shepherd boy from Hungary, the midnight dance from Russia, the three girls, a gypsy version of the tale. There is also the 7 iron slippers from Portugal, the 12 dancing princesses from France, and finally, the slippers of the 12 princesses from Romania, on which our tale is based. There is a Scottish variation, Cake Crackernuts, but it has a gender swap, and it's the prince who's doomed to illness and exhaustion by being forced to dance all night. Slippers don't appear in that one, if you remember it from my previous episode, but there is an excellent sheep's head element that's not to be missed. I'm going to contradict myself slightly and say that there are elements of the story that appear further afield in Turkey, Bangladesh and India, but they're different enough not to be discussed at length here. There is also a garden which contains silver, gold and diamond leaves in the epic story of Gilgamesh from Sumeria. The tale I was going to tell originally is a French version found in the Red Fairy Book as translated by Andrew Lang. Or, much more likely, Leonora Lang, his wife. It's based on the tale as written by Charles Dullin and included in his Tales of King Cambrinus, 1874. Charles Dullin adapted folk tales and brought them to life by infusing them with the language and places of the time in which he lived. He also included elements of other tales. There's a section of this one which is lifted straight from Basile's Cat Cinderella. If you've heard that in a previous episode, let's see if you can spot it. This caused me much confusion, as I've heard this story long before I discovered the Pentamerone, although Basile Cenerentola is much older. When I read Cenerentola, I knew I had heard that exact plot device, but I couldn't remember where, as it doesn't appear in the Grimm version of the tale. Ashleman believes that Lang's version was translated from a version by Madame d'Aulnoy, but he credits all her other tales to her in the Red Fairy Book, but not this one. He also mentions other French sources. I've read Dulin's tale in French, and I think the version in the Red Fairy Book is a direct translation. It even includes the same names of the main characters, and the castle name is also the same. The borrowed Basile elements are there too. I'm far from an expert though, and I'm very willing to be corrected on this, as my French translation skills are rusty, although excellent still for anything you might find on a menu. The Romanian version of the tale from Romanian Tales and Legends but Emir Moya is very similar to the French tale, and as I haven't told a Romanian tale so far, I thought I'd tell you this version. I've kept the description of the feast from the French tale, as it felt more like the type of feast that would be available in an underground magical kingdom. The original Romanian tale lists the finest meats and wines, which are perhaps more in keeping with the cuisine of that country. So, after all that, why do I like this? Do I still like it? I like the fact that, unlike many more modern variants, the princesses are not under a curse to dance. They truly love to dance and feast in a beautiful underground wonderland, wearing beautiful dresses and jewels accompanied by handsome princes. They are perfectly prepared to curse the princes to lose all feelings except the desire to dance, or, in some variations, allow them to be executed to hide the fact that they are doing this just so they can continue. It's fairly heartless, and they show no remorse. Their traditional beauty here is definitely not symbolic of their virtue. So, our cowherd is the hero, but the princesses do not really need to be saved. If anything, they could be said to be the villains of the tale. However, when you consider the traditional role for women was to marry and have children, you can see why they wanted to have some fun and enjoyment, rather than enter into the next stage of life, which could be hard and dangerous for all women, even princesses. Childhood without good medical support is very dangerous, and there was no protection from potential domestic abuse, and no guarantee that life with your new family would be a pleasant one. There was also no escape. You can see why the princesses might have been happy to sacrifice a few princes they didn't know so they could continue with their joyful dancing. The element of risk in the tale for the princes, who tried to discover what had happened to the princesses, had been toned down by later collectors, including Lang, but historically that risk needed to be there to balance out the great reward of winning both Princess's Bride as well as the country itself. I think this quote from the classic fairy tales by Iona and Peter Opie says it all. The do-or-die terms offered to candidates for a princess's hand are not uncommon in popular literature, but Victorian editors found their harshness unacceptable. In the age of self-help, it was not thinkable that those who strove and failed should be worse off than those who had never striven. This tale also makes good use of the traditional 3 days and three nights given to solve a task. The rule of three allows the story to fully develop and build suspense, and also makes it easier to remember for the storyteller and the audience. It also removes any suggestion that the things that are happening in the story could be coincidental. The third night also indicates that things are coming to an end, or crescendo as the rhythm changes. This Romanian version is unusual in that it breaks the rule for Jonica because he isn't officially completing the task. This tale also has food for princesses. Literally, the type of food princesses like, which seems to be light, delicate things and flowered favoured delicacies in particular. I find the idea of this type of food to be particularly magical in the setting of a magical land. Often the food in fairy tales isn't delicate, it's substantial, which is what you would expect when lack of food was never far away from most of the people who heard and told these stories. This food, however, is supposed to show us that we aren't in Kansas anymore, and reflects the other magical surroundings, including the gold, silver and diamond forests, and the enchanted princes. So, I thought it gave me a good excuse to investigate the role of edible flowers in history and today. I'm going to start off by betting that most of you eat flowers fairly regularly, and not because you're forced to take part in children's garden tea parties regularly. You do, but they aren't the princess-friendly type. How do you feel about broccoli? Those are flower buds, and the cauliflower cheese you ate with your Sunday roast? Yep, flower as well. It's literally in the name. We just don't think about it. I'm not going to cheat here, though, and I'm going to look at the history of edible flowers that we would all recognise as flowers. I imagine that in the UK, most people's experience of eating flowers starts and ends with Parma violets and rose Turkish delight, although I allow you a possible violet cream or rose water in your Indian and Middle Eastern sweets. I'm one of those happy few that love Parma violets with a passion and usually benefit from being the only person in office that likes them. I also love rose water and rose Turkish delight, even fries, as well as enjoying Turkish rose jam and thick yoghurt on a spring morning. I'm seasonally specific with certain foods. I was brought up that way, the daughter and granddaughter of women who love floral flavours in food but avoid them in perfume. Is it a genetic thing, do you think? I imagine it's at the bottom of the list when it comes to genetic research, but someday they might get to it. Anyway, we've dwindled down to only having flowers and sweet things, really, unless you count all those irresponsible people who scatter poisonous plants over their food to make them beautiful for Instagram. Please don't put anemones, lily of the valley, baby's breath, poppies, foxgloves or daffodils or lily others anywhere near your food.
arranged beautifully in a jar or vase is fine, obviously. And I'll allow that sprig of holly on your Christmas pudding because everyone knows you don't eat it. There are so many flowers you can use, like roses, violets, edible pansies, marigolds, nasturtiums and elderflowers, which won't make anyone poorly. Now we've stopped trying to poison our friends and family, even if only accidentally, we need to go to ancient Rome. Well, we don't need to go, but I'd love it if you came along for the ride to visit Marcus Gavius Apicius. You may well know of him. The first ever cookbook is often attributed to him. It was known as De Re Coquinaria, on the subject of cooking, and the first edition was apparently from the 1st century CE. The earliest edition still in existence is from the 5th century CE, and although some of the recipes are attributed to Marcus, it's unlikely he had anything to do with it. Marcus was a famous gourmand, though, so it wouldn't have been a wasted trip. Additionally, there's a story of a Roman emperor, Heliogabalus, who smothered people to death in flower petals at a dinner. So, the Romans definitely took floral flavours seriously. The book itself contains many flower recipes, and thankfully for us, a very nice man called Joseph Domus Veiling translated it into English for us in the 19th century. Otherwise, I've had to get out either my Latin or German dictionaries and done a lot of swearing. If you're looking for an excellent recipe for peas a la vitellus, or chicken force meatballs, or even need a list of those flowers for cooking that the house shouldn't be without, then this is the book for you. There are recipes for violet and rose wines, a tradition of making flower wines that continued well into the late 20th century, even if only at home. There's also a recipe for rose wine without the roses, which suggests something about the writer. In our enthusiasm for ancient Rome, we've also skipped over a particularly well-known text. I know we don't necessarily think of the Bible first when we consider food, but it lists dandelions as one of the bitter herbs eaten as a salad with a paschal lamb and unleavened bread at the Hebrew holy day of Passover. The Song of Solomon also mentions saffron. There's also a good history from the Middle Ages to the 18th century in Europe of eating flowers and salads, and as part of meals including marigolds, nasturtiums, violets and roses. There's a wonderful essay by Claire Clifton who is searching for the origin of a salad that appears in E for Exquisite by M.F.K. Fisher, where she describes that what she once felt was the most exquisite dish she'd ever heard of, as a satiny white endive with large heavily scented parma violets scattered through it. The essay forms part of the proceedings of the Oxford Symposium of Food and Cookery, 1984 and 1985, which were available online with many wonderful articles as well. They were also used to make flower waters and cordials as soon as distilling became a skill. Candying of flowers so they could dress sweetmeats or platters was also very popular, and we can still get some of candied flowers mentioned in the story even now. Vinegars, including primrose vinegar, were still being made at the beginning of the 19th century, but that's when things started to change. The big change to the status eating of French cookery during the Victorian period was very much the end of flower eating in Britain, except in wines made at home, definitely not drunk at dinner, and the candied flowers used to decorate cakes. Even that disappeared mostly with the invention of modelling icing. They were still used in salads in France, though, with very specific rules. Only a few items remain, although they definitely never completely went away in the UK. There is a wonderful book called The Gentle Art of Cookery by Mrs. C.F. Lael, who founded Culpeper, and Miss Olga Hartley, who didn't, printed in 1925, which has a whole chapter of flower recipes. One of our most wonderful food writers, Florence White, also wrote a book for cooking with flowers in 1934 called Flowers as Food, which has now been reprinted. They also popped up in cooking ideas during wartime rationing, where if it didn't move and it wasn't poisonous, then people would give it cooking it a go. It's been a big move towards eating flowers in more recent times, when foraging has become more usual and famous chefs in Denmark and Sweden are using them in their kitchens. There are even recipes all over the internet, especially for salads, which look beautiful, but I have to admit I haven't tried them. There aren't many places I could easily buy flowers that I know haven't been treated with terrifying pesticides, and I am not a gardener. That's even without considering that my garden is down the water table from an old Edwardian hospital, which was, shall we say, less than careful with what it did with its heavy metal waste. So, that's my long-winded way of saying there'll be no princess-suitable flower-based recipes here today. I'm going to cheat here, which I didn't do in my historical investigation, and give you my recipe for cauliflower cheese instead. It's wonderful and ridiculously cheesy, so I hope you'll forgive me. I use cheddar and parmesan in my cheese sauce with reckless regard for anything Elizabeth David might say, and I pre-bake my cauliflower to avoid both washing up and too crunchy cauliflower. Unlike many of my recipes, I have no story about this that involves any of my maternal relatives. Cauliflower is one of the few foods my mum won't give plate to, room to, and even Nan wasn't that bothered. I really love it though, and not just as a vehicle for cheese sauce, so I refuse to apologise for this recipe. As I said before, cauliflower is a flower, it's actually in the name. So, that brings us to the end of this episode, I think. I wonder if you'd do me a big favour and would go on and review the podcast. It would help so many more people find it, and I'd really, really appreciate it. Obviously, 5 stars. 5 stars. But I'd be just as pleased if you shared this with friends or family or online. If you'd like to get in touch about anything that's been in this podcast or any others, please don't hesitate to get in touch online. I'm at FairyTalesFood on Instagram and on Twitter. My contact details are in the show notes, along with the recipe, and some further reading about some of the things that I've discussed today, and some of the publications that I've mentioned. I think that's it. Thanks again for listening to Folklore, Food and Fairy Tales.